Good afternoon and welcome. My name is Richard Gage, AIA. I'm a member of the American Institute of Architects. I've been a licensed architect for 22 years, and I'm the founder of the nonprofit organization Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. As a group, we now have 1,270 architects and engineer petition signers. Collectively, we have more than 25,000 years of building and technical experience. This press conference today is being given by our petition signers and supporters in 65 locations around the world, including 30 states and 4 countries. Today, we're here to inform you that we have uncovered evidence that the official investigations into what happened to the World Trade Center skyscrapers on 9/11 were deeply flawed or worse. The scientific forensic facts we have discovered have very troubling implications. For example, a technologically advanced, highly energetic material has been discovered in the World Trade Center dust from the 9/11 catastrophe. This follows the discovery by the United States Geological Survey and others of high concentrations of unusual, previously molten iron microspheres in the World Trade Center dust. These microspheres can only have been formed during the destruction of the World Trade Center at temperatures far higher than can be explained by jet fuel and office fires. Those fires, we are told by engineers employed by NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, were allegedly the cause of the World Trade Center's destruction. The discovery of this advanced energetic material in the form of red-gray chips distributed throughout the dust both explains the iron-rich microspheres and confirms the inadequacy of the official account of what happened that tragic day. Even before the microspheres and red-gray chips had been identified and brought to our attention, we were deeply concerned about other aspects of the destruction of these iconic buildings and how they were investigated. More than 24 firefighters, engineers, and other witnesses reported seeing substantial quantities of molten iron or steel flowing like lava in the debris under the 3 World Trade Center high-rises. Office fires and jet fuel cannot possibly reach temperatures necessary to liquefy iron or steel. A mixture called thermite, consisting of pulverized iron oxide and aluminum, can generate temperatures above 4,000 degrees, far more than is needed to melt iron or steel, which melts at about 2,750 degrees. The energetic material that was found in the World Trade Center dust by an international team of scientists led by Niels Harrit of the University of Copenhagen in Denmark was reported in the peer-reviewed Bentham Open Journal of Chemical Physics. It consists of nano-engineered iron oxide and aluminum particles, 1/1,000th the size of a human hair, embedded in another substance consisting of carbon, oxygen, and silicon. The sizes of the iron oxide particles are extremely uniform, and neither they nor the ultra-fine-grain aluminum platelets could possibly have been created by a natural process such as a gravitational collapse or impact of jetliners. The red-gray chips in which these particles were found exhibit the same characteristics as advanced energetic materials developed in U.S. national laboratories in the years leading up to 9/11. They have no reason for being in the World Trade Center dust. Given all the horrific costs in human lives, lost civil liberties, and trillions of tax dollars spent in response to the official account of 9/11, there can be no more urgent need than for our country and the world to find out who put these materials in the World Trade Center and why. This need makes it all the more disturbing that top engineers in charge of the government's investigation would avoid dealing straightforwardly with all the evidence that AE 9/11 Truth and others have repeatedly brought to their attention, much of which has been available in the public record since the beginning. John Gross, NIST co-project leader, has denied the existence of, or even reports of, molten iron or steel in the World Trade Center. They stopped their analysis of the tower's complete and highly energetic destruction at the very point when the destruction begins. And they have dismissed or avoided serious analysis of the additional evidence which we are concerned with. For instance, one, both twin towers were completely dismembered and destroyed in just 10 to 14 seconds, which occurs at near freefall acceleration. For this to happen, all 47 massive core columns, as well as a large fraction of their external columns, would have to be compromised with explosives beforehand. Two, more than 100 first responders reported hearing explosions and seeing flashes of light at the onset of destruction. Light flashes indicate explosive detonations. And this from the New York Fire Commission, Commissioner Thomas von Essen's oral histories. Three, multi-ton steel perimeter wall sections were ejected laterally up to 60 miles per hour, landing over 600 feet away. That speed and distance indicates a high-pressure explosion initiating the ejections. Four, 90,000 tons of concrete in this building and its metal decking under the floors were pulverized in midair, again, indicating explosions. Five, World Trade Center 7, a 47-story high-rise, which was not hit by an aircraft, came down in pure free-fall acceleration for more than 100 feet of its descent. A significant fact that NIST's Shyam Sunder was forced to admit after being presented with research from our team. Yet, NIST has failed to review or acknowledge the obvious implications of this fact, which is that the columns must have been explosively severed within fractions of a second of each other. The complete destruction and dismemberment of Building 7, collapsing in just 6.5 seconds at freefall acceleration through the path of what was the greatest resistance, the thousands of tons of structural steel in this building, occurs at pure freefall, zero resistance from any of those columns. This is an occurrence only possible with expertly placed explosives. There are other falsehoods and omissions in NIST's official report. One, NIST overstated the severity and duration of the fires in all three skyscrapers, apparently in order to more credibly attribute the destruction to the fires, yet without exaggerating them enough to account for molten iron or steel. Two, NIST and FEMA did not follow the National Fire Protection Association's standard procedures for fire and explosion investigation and test the building debris for explosive residues. NIST did not test for explosives when explosive demolition was the most likely hypothesis. They refuse to test today, even though given this evidence. Four, NIST's animated computer model of Building 7's destruction, showing the outer walls crumpling inward like a piece of foil, bears no resemblance to the actual collapse as seen in the videos. NIST claims that the falling section of each of the twin towers above the jetliner impact zones crushed the much larger and more massive intact lower section. But video analysis reveals clearly that the upper sections above the point of jet plane impacts disintegrated in waves of explosions prior to any crushing of the lower sections of the building. This indicates that the top sections could not have been the cause of the destruction of the lower sections. Six, NIST's technical analysis into the Twin Towers collapse stops at the initiation of collapse. There is no technical analysis of the structural behavior of the building during the collapse itself. In response to our request for correction on this matter, NIST acknowledged simply that they were unable to provide a full explanation of the total collapse. In short, NIST's official technical explanation is fraudulent and certainly inconsistent with the basic laws of physics. By contrast, the hypothesis of controlled demolition is consistent with all of the available technical evidence and data. This week, here in Washington, D.C., we personally delivered a startling DVD, including the highlights of the forensic evidence into the hands of staffers for the science advisors of almost every elected representative on Capitol Hill. In addition, we have sat down with over a dozen of them and presented in detail the overwhelming evidence of explosive controlled demolition. We have personally invited over 400 of them to today's event. Are there any congressional science advisors here today? A telling sign. I urge you to go to our website, ae911truth.org, for more information, including comments by our members on the problems with the official investigation. At this point, we are calling for Attorney General Eric Holder to ask a federal grand jury to investigate those responsible for the NIST report, including lead investigator Shyam Sunder and co-project leader John Gross. We'd like any and all reporters who will be covering this story to know that architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth are here to give you any and all technical support that you need. Finally, I'd like to thank the thousands of scientists, senior-level members of the military, intelligence and other government officials, pilots and aviation professionals, firefighters, scholars and university professionals, 9/11 survivors and their family members, and concerned citizens here and around the world for their continuing support. And today in Los Angeles and New York, there is a simultaneous press conference announcing the creation of yet three more 9/11 Truth groups, scientists for 9/11 Truth and military professionals, military officers for 9/11 Truth. We also want to thank our growing family of more than 300 sustaining financial supporters. We could not accomplish our critical work and our mission, which is to get a new investigation into these matters. We could not accomplish it without you. Now I'll answer any quick questions you might have. Keep in mind that most of your questions will probably be answered also during our mock debate, which is immediately to follow. Also, a more detailed information set is available in our DVD, 9/11 Blueprint for Truth, which is available right in the back here. The Architecture of Destruction, this DVD is subtitled, which is available on our website, also ae911truth.org. Are there any questions? Yes. Hold on 1 second. Do we have a microphone, a floor mic? Can you come up to the mic? I'm sorry. That would be very helpful for everybody. Thank you. Right over here. And if you have a question, would you line up behind the young lady? Or step up to the mic.
My name is Morel Torjman. I'm a federal whistleblower. I have been attempting for 4 years and impeded to speak. On my story, I have just filed a case with the United States Supreme Court. And my question is, are you familiar with the Russell Tice case, the NSA conducting electronic warfare on Americans that involved the 9/11 on many levels with this technology weapon that I have proof of?
No. The architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth focus on the destruction of the three World Trade Center high-rise and getting a new investigation for that set of issues. And your issue sounds very important, and I applaud you. I don't know anything about it.
It is. And it's right on to your scientific proof. The electronic warfare are the weapons of mass destruction. The focus is should not be on the nuclear aspect of it, but the technology-directed energy weapons, which is the debris that was quickly removed.
Thank you. We can have the next question, please. Right behind you. Sorry.
Hi, my name is David Nolan. I'm the founder of the Federal Ethics Center, and what I do for a living is protect whistleblowers, federal employees, from reprisals for their protected disclosures, which tend to protect Americans and national security rather than injure it. I guess my question is, have you looked into any irregularities regarding the 9/11 crash into the Pentagon? I have a client who was lobbying for the No Fear Act on Capitol Hill, where she and NAACP leader Leroy Warren witnessed a low-flying commercial airliner.
Well, let me answer the question, and I appreciate your need to share your story. I'm going to ask the questions to be brief to honor the presses here and the intense schedule for the mock debate that we have. The architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth focus on the three World Trade Center high-rises. We all agree in the 9/11 Truth movement that the need for an investigation at the Pentagon is also paramount. We know what we call for the release of the numerous videos that would clearly show what did or did not hit the Pentagon. So we are united on that front. Thank you very much. Are there any other questions? Would you mind stepping up? Welcome back. I wanted to give everybody a chance. And please,
two important statements.
If you could just ask the question, please, I would appreciate it.
One is the death rays for plane with the Warden Cliff Tower on Long Island that reaches 250 miles. That will melt down any engine and on PSYOPs on the pilot and the co-pilot.
Do you have a question for us today?
Do you have knowledge of the invisible Chinese wall that surrounds from New York to Washington?
No, I don't know about that.
Okay. And how about Operation Mockingbird on the media unwittingly to suppress all this information for 9 years?
I'm aware of Operation Mockingbird. I'm not
psychologically.
Okay. I'm aware that it's a CIA operation, and they worked with the media. And I would encourage everybody to Google that.
Okay.
Is there another question? Go ahead.
Sunstein, Obama, and the Sunstein's cognitive impairment and infiltration into the media and the public and mass control. Three people have been murdered on PSYOPs operating on U.S. soil and civilians related to 9/11.
Thank you.
I have a website at exposingalltruth.com with all the facts.
Mm-hmm. And David Ray Griffin has written an excellent book on this subject, cognitive infiltration. It's a fascinating subject. Thank you. I appreciate you bringing it to our attention. Next.
I'm Armand Chaudhry, an architect from Philadelphia. Richard, thank you and to your team for what you do and compiling all this evidence. But it seems it is not having much traction in the government. My question to you, are you willing to take all this evidence that you have compiled to the UN, to the Interpol, to the EU, or the war crime tribunals at The Hague?
All of those alternative venues for justice are being considered. We are not attorneys or adept in these fields. We're technical and building professionals. We have a committee exploring these issues, and I would encourage you to contact us and assist us in that regard. We are starting with Congress because this is our Constitution. It has a path of justice. We need to pursue it. Whether we will be successful or not is a question, but we won't give up on the path that has been laid for us by our forefathers. If that path doesn't work, certainly international venues for justice are on everybody's mind.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. My name is Dick Gregory, and I just want to say thank you.
Thank you.
What a wonderful gathering. I see a lot of the original suspects there. But again, thank you. And many of us feel your pain. You know, you're very important because it just can't wash you off like you laying in bed one day and had a dream. I feel the pain here with people who have information, but what you're doing is very needed. It's like I'm going to a brain surgeon to see if you can fix my foot. That's not what you're doing. You're doing one thing, and we appreciate that. And so, again, I say thanks to you, and I've been with Brother Wolf and Jeff all night just waiting to come here. We're going to New York, and there is another level you all can go to while we're waiting on this. And I'm fixing to announce tomorrow that I'll be 80 years old on October the 12th of 2012, and starting tomorrow in New York, I'm going on a 2-year fast where I'm not going to eat no solid food. Somebody asked me, say, you've been fasting 40 years, what do your doctor think? My doctor been dead 30 years. But going on a 2-year fast of nothing but liquids, and just ask folks around the world that tune in every day at 12 o'clock where you are, and just pray and meditate that the truth come out. Now, the CIA can manipulate a whole lot of stuff, but they can't manipulate the Big Dipper in the Milky Way. And there is a universal force that put this whole piece together that can't be manipulated. And so I will tune in and ask people to tune in, and I will also tune in to you all's success. And again, I just say thank you. And if you want information on what we're doing, I'll be back in the back. And you agents that's here, it's going to cost you $30 to get it.
Thank you, Dick. We're honored to have you. And this will be our last question.
My name is Maria Garcia. I'm with the Mexican News Agency. I wonder if the nanoparticles that you found in the site has any relation with the health problems that occur in the firefighters and other persons who help to the rescue.
There are reports from the medical people that they have found particles of iron in people's lungs. I don't know what percentage of that is the problem that is killing almost 1,000 people after 9/11 or not. There are certainly enough toxic materials, including asbestos and mercury and radioactive substances. So these things need to be investigated. Thank you. The question is about Larry Silverstein, the owner. Larry Silverstein purchased in a 99-year lease the World Trade Center from the Port Authority of New York, and that deal just cleared 6 weeks prior to 9/11. He's implicated in a number of statements that are controversial that we don't explore too much. We look at the technical evidence that is very hard evidence for the explosive demolition of these buildings. At this time, I'd like to invite Dave Schlesinger, AE 911 Truth coordinator for our congressional outreach team. Dave?
Thank you. Come on. Yes, our team is one of more than a dozen different teams which we invite people to join. The host of our mock debate today is former senator and presidential candidate Mike Gravel of Alaska. Most people don't know that Mike Gravel became Speaker of the Alaska House of Representatives in only his second term. An early and courageous opponent of America's war in Vietnam, Senator Gravel filibustered the Senate by himself to end the war by stopping the draft. And when Daniel Ellsberg sought a senator to read the Pentagon Papers into the congressional record, it was Senator Gravel alone who had the courage to stand up to the Washington War Establishment and make those papers public property. He's the founder of the Democracy Foundation, an organization that seeks a constitutional amendment to allow citizens to enact laws through ballot initiatives when their representatives fail them. As Democratic candidate for president, in 2007, he demanded an immediate end to the war in Iraq and an end to the dominance of the military-industrial complex over national policy. As Libertarian candidate for president in 2008, he demanded an end to the cycle of American imperialism and endorsed the New York City 9/11 ballot initiative to create a private citizens commission with subpoena power against even the highest government officials to make a true investigation as to what happened on September 11th, 2001. It's an honor to introduce one of America's true profiles in courage, Senator Mike Gravel.
Great. Thank you. Thank you all for coming. The title of this mock conference is, or debate, if you will, it's not much of a debate, is Hard Evidence of Explosive Demolition at the World Trade Center on 9/11. That is quite an indictment when you fully appreciate what hard evidence really means. We're dealing today with this very difficult subject, and we ask why after 9 years, and we're so close to the anniversary, why revisit this subject? There's several good reasons why. One is, it was the occasion for two wars, one which is, quote, supposedly ending, and the other, which is continuing, which has cost the lives of several million people worldwide. That's one reason. There's another closer to home, and that is what we've done to our civil society with the Patriot Act, with the military tribunals, with the legitimization of torture, where the United States worldwide is now recognized as a country that engages in torture. And this evidence is overwhelming. So if there's any reason why we should look at this again, it's got to be for those reasons. We can't live with that anymore. Now, the whole concept, and that's the part of the mock side, is that there's a body of people that feel that this has been adequately investigated. Well, I got to tell you, that's not exactly accurate, because the investigation was not what we call an investigation. It was to develop a storyline of what happened to be fed to the American people and to receive their acquiescence. When you stop and think, the investigation, which essentially was opposed by the presidential White House at the time, and it was the victims' families who pressed to get this investigation going to begin with. And so they threw at this $600,000 and put together a staff of volunteers. Well, the spokesman for FEMA made the statement that we are not an investigative agency. And of course, in some degrees, they're not. And that's quoted in the New York Times. At the very time that FEMA was doing this work, developing a storyline, truckloads upon truckloads of the debris was being hauled away. And I'm glad that somebody saved the dust so you could go in and make an examination of what they found. The commission report was not tasked as an investigative body. They weren't there to investigate. They were made up of basically politicians and government appointees, and very few engineers. The commission publicly stated, senior counsel for the commission publicly stated, and I'm quoting, that the commission was a compromise, fraudulent, or invalid. Thomas Kern and Lee Hamilton, the governor of New Jersey, and Lee Hamilton, a distinguished member of Congress, co-chaired the 9/11 Commission. They said that their report, and they were being very political in this regard, was not to be considered the last word. This is candor. Not to be considered the last word, but just the beginning of the discovery of what happened. In their book, Without Precedent, they wrote that the Commission had been set up to fail. Now, these are the two guys that were placed in charge of it. They said they had considered referring top military officers for prosecution, for obstructing the investigation. And they were informed, well, you don't have that authority, and so bypass that. Just as a side, our intelligence community was budgeted at the time of 9/11 at $26 billion a year. No person has ever been fired for incompetence, and their budget is now $75 billion a year. Hamilton has also said that people should keep asking questions about 9/11 and that the debate should continue. But the only people responding to that are these gentlemen and the victims, some of the victims' families that are responding to that do want to see this continue and a dialogue and investigation take place. Senator Max Cleland, who lost both his legs in the Vietnam War, was appointed to the commission, declaring that it had been that the commission had been compromised and was a national scandal. America is being cheated, Cleland was quoted in Salon. The White House wants to cover it up. Well, many of us had that same sense. But when you have a person on the inside who's privy to the information, you now know that it's a little more than just wishful thinking. Commissioner Timothy Romer told CNN, "We were extremely frustrated with the false statements we were getting." Commissioner John Lehman told NBC Nightly News, "We purposely put together a staff that had conflicts of interest." Commissioner Bob Carey was quoted on Salon, "There are ample reasons to suspect that there may be some alternative to what we outlined in our version," which, of course, alternatives were never examined. Senior counsel for the 9/11 Commission, John Farmer, who led the staff inquiry, was quoted in the Washington Post, "I was shocked at how different the truth was from the way it was described. The tapes told a radically different story from what had been told to us and the public for 2 years." Current Republican Congressman Ron Paul joins his voice in calling the investigation fraudulent and a cover-up. You have also Congressman Dennis Kucinich, who's articulated this, and Senator Lincoln Chafee, a Republican of independent bent, endorsed a new 9/11 investigation. The former U.S. Congressman Dan Hamburg actually stated that the U.S. government assisted in the 9/11 attack, adding that, "I think there was a lot of help from the inside." These are responsible people, may have their prejudices and their biases, but it's nothing that one should discount when looking at the product of this investigation. The nonprofit organization NYC Coalition for Accountability Now, whose board includes 9/11 victim family members, is seeking a 9/11 investigation at the state and federal levels. Victims' family members, at whose insistence the 9/11 Commission was formed, have said that only a fourth of their well-researched questions were answered, and many of the rest of their questions were not even pursued by the Commission. For example, the collapse of the World Trade Center Building 7, which baffled engineers, and you'll hear more about that in this debate, was not even mentioned in the committee's report, the commission's report. The 10,000 pages report by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, a government agency that is part of the Department of Commerce, explicitly avoided analyzing the behavior of the Twin Towers after the collapse began. The focus of the study was on how each tower became poised for collapse by the damage caused by the jetliner impact and resulting fires. On the assumption that those were the causes, no other hypothesis was brought forth, about how these skyscrapers were brought down or discussed in the report. More broadly, when Colin Powell was trying to get the UN to authorize U.S. action to go after Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, now mind you, this wasn't the appearance before the UN where he lied about the intelligence that we had. This was earlier. He promised to provide the evidence of al-Qaeda's involvement in 9/11, a white paper, which has never materialized. To this day, the FBI website does not list Osama bin Laden as being sought in connection with the 9/11 attacks, with its spokesman explaining that there is no hard evidence linking bin Laden to the attack. FBI Director Mueller admitted that not a single piece of paper linked the officially named suspect in the attack. So there appears to be some strong reason for revisiting the key issues surrounding 9/11. Today, we will be discussing in particular the events that led up to the greatest loss of life on 9/11, not the jetliner impact and resulting fires at the World Trade Center, but rather the destruction of the World Trade Center Twin Towers less than 2 hours later. We will also examine the mysterious complete collapse of Building 7. Engineers associated with the United States government blame the destruction of all three of these modern steel frame skyscrapers on the jetliner impact and fires. It is outlandish to doubt their conclusions, is it? Many people have doubts about the beginning. Over the year, a whole movement has arisen consisting of concerned citizens all over the world, the so-called 9/11 truth movement. Movements like this start out because the government doesn't do its job, and so people thinking the worst then are abroad with all hosts of conspiracies. But that's not what this debate is about. We're talking about a body of people with the technology and the knowledge to deal with the specifics, not the political aspects of it, with the specific technical elements involved in the destruction of the Trade Center and Building 7. According to a Zogby poll in 2007, 51% of Americans questioned the official 9/11 account. Well, we're going to take our own poll right here, right now. And then after you've had a chance to see the argumentation on both sides, we'll take another poll. But right now, let me ask you three questions. One, and raise your hands after this. How many of you pretty much believe the official account of the high-rise collapses? That the planes impacted the buildings and there was a large explosion of jet fuel and ignition of fires, weakening the structural steel, and a gravitational collapse brought down everything to the ground. Raise your hands. Oh, okay, let me read the other two questions. How many are unsure, and about how many already believe that the Twin Towers were brought down by controlled demolition? First question. Now, how many pretty much believe the official account? Raise your hands. Wow. Well, she's not sure. Okay. Then nobody's raised her hand that I can see. Yeah, you got to vote. And nobody's voting. One in the back, I can't see. Okay. Okay. The next one is, how many are you unsure? One, two, three, four. Five. Press TV doesn't count. Okay, got four or five, right? Okay, and then the last one. How many already believe that the Twin Towers were brought down by controlled demolition? Well, we don't have to have a debate. It's already been settled. You want to count them all?
Yeah.
Raise your hands and keep them up, because we do want to have a record of this.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. The nonprofit organization, Architects and Engineers of 9/11, referred to as AE 9/11 Truth, has examined a great deal of evidence available in the public record and has also concluded that the Twin Towers and the lesser-known World Trade Center Building 7 were destroyed by explosive controlled demolition. They have a petition that they've delivered to the Congress earlier this year. It has been signed by over 1,270 professionals, technical professionals, licensed and degreed architects and engineers, with well over 1,000, with thousands of additional supporters. And as was pointed out by Richard, Congress has not responded, even to the most recent information, has not responded at all or shown any interest at all in doing anything about this. Richard also pointed out that there was three groups that were being formed as we speak today. One is military officers, the other is scientists, and, of course, actors and supporters like myself, who are not technicians, but they have some sense of how the world works. The military officers, you've got Commander Ralph Kolstad and Colonel George Nels. The scientists are David Grissom, Lynn Margulis, and A.K. Doudny. The AE 9/11 Truth crossed the historic milestone of 100,000 people joining with their signature petitions on September 11, 2001. February 19th is when they reached that threshold. On that day, they sent a petition to Congress, and of course, you've already heard that there was no response. To date, AE 9/11 Truth is represented here today by four of its petition signers. These are gentlemen at the table. There's Richard Gage on my immediate left. Next is Tom Zimbati, and then Tony. I'm sorry, I apologize. And the other gentleman is Greg Roberts, who's took off for a moment here, Steve. Thank you, Steve. The correction. We will now proceed with the statements and rebuttals forming the actual mock debate. Now, bear in mind, the people who hold to the government storyline were invited to join us today. Only one member said he would, and, of course, his schedule did not permit him to do that. And so we will now go forward with the slide presentation of the individuals and their statements, which you'll be able to see, and then you'll be able to see and hear the actual facts presented by AE 9/11 Truth. So the first one that we will start with is Mr. Meggs.
Shalom Sunder, we need to introduce all of these. Can you read this? Just read them in order. I'll flash.
Yeah. Lead World Trade Center Investigator for the National Institute of Standards and Technology, Shyam Sunder.
Next.
John Gross, Co-Project Leader, WTC Investigations. Materials Engineer Sedanek Barzan submitted a technical paper explaining the collapse 2 days after 9/11. 2 days after 9/11, he had it all figured out. One of the lead, Leslie Robertson, one of the lead engineers involved with WTC Twin Towers construction. Ronald Hamburger, structural engineer appointed by FEMA to perform the initial investigation for WTC collapse, later participated in a more detailed study by NIST. Gene Corley, structural engineer, OKC bombing investigator, lead investigator for FEMA WTC collapse investigation. Dave Thomas, president of Mexican for Science and Reason, debated a 9/11 truth on Coast to Coast AM. James Meggs, chief editor of Popular Mechanics, wrote Debunking 9/11 Myth, Why Conspiracy Theories Can't Stand Up to the Facts. Michael Shermer, founding publisher of Skeptical Magazine, wrote op-ed 9/11, Truthers Are a Pack of Lies, in Huffington Post.
Forget him.
Thomas Eger, MIT materials engineer, co-wrote Why Did the World Trade Center Collapse? Science, Engineering, and Speculation.
Can't hear you very well.
Van Romero, vice president of research and economic developments at New Mexico Tech, explosive expert lobbyist. Brent Blanchard, explosive expert, implosionworld.com, wrote a critical analysis of the collapse of WTC Towers 1, 2, and 7 from an explosives and conventional demolition industry viewpoint. Abdulhassan Ashtanet Als, UC Berkeley professor of civil environment engineer, presented Learning from 9/11, Understanding the Collapse of the World Trade Center, to House Science Committee. John Magnuson, chairman, CEO, WTC design firm, Skillings Ward, Magnuson, Berkshire, Inc., board member, structural engineers, Institute of Board of Governors. Hyman Brown, vice president, Tishman Realty and Construction, Los Angeles, credited with various roles at WTC, but confirmed top people there don't remember him. The mock debate begins. James Meggs, appearance of CDs.
You'll hear conspiracy theories say, look at this, doesn't it look like a controlled demolition? Well, it turns out this is what buildings look like when they fall down.
Well, is that true? What do buildings look like when they fall down? Let's take a look at a few buildings that fell down and see if they look anything at all like these three World Trade Center skyscrapers. Here's some buildings that fell down. They fall over. Why? Because they're injured or damaged on the side on one side or the other. It's an organic, asymmetrical, chaotic process that causes buildings to fall. In this case, the structural steel is not dismembered. The concrete is not pulverized. It's not a symmetrical pile. There's a building at the bottom of this pile. So, Stephen, can you help us, structurally speaking, why do buildings fall this way instead of the way they might fall at the World Trade Center?
Well, the original design encompasses a structural system that's completely integrated with all the components. And that's why these buildings are still intact when they're down on the ground, is because all these structural systems tie them together and maintain the integrity of the building, even though the foundation failed or whatever, to fall over. The difference with the World Trade Center building is a complete dismemberment of all portions of the structure can't be explained by the failure of single members or lack of stability causing the building to fall over. So it's basically the total destruction of the buildings is what is inconsistent with the buildings that are just falling over from a gravitational collapse.
And by the way, Stephen is a 37-year structural engineer in Las Vegas. Tony Zambodi is a 37-year mechanical engineer in Pennsylvania.
About 30, actually.
30, okay. And in New Jersey.
Right outside of Philadelphia.
And Greg Roberts is an author, one of the authors of the nanothermite, the active thermitic materials. in the World Trade Center dust paper. He assisted Dr. Jones, Niels Harrod, and others to put their work to the test of scientific scrutiny. Well, let's take a look at what what engineered destructive processes look like. In this case, a typical classic controlled demolition, something Steve might have seen in Las Vegas quite a bit, these old hotels, they have a specific set of characteristics. Let's take a look at these one at a time. This is a classic controlled demolition. We have hundreds of examples from all across the country from which to make our comparison because it's the most commonly used method to bring down high-rises. So this is what a high-rise looks like when it's being demolished with explosives. Controlled demolitions can be engineered in many ways. The purpose, of course, is to remove a structure while avoiding damage to adjacent structures and to do so economically. Typically, a tall building like this is demolished by placing thousands of cutter charges throughout the columns and beams in the building and then detonating them in a very precise order, starting with the interior structure progressing outwards and upward, synchronistically timed floor by floor. Destroying the interior columns allows the unsupported weight to pull the exterior inward, and destroying the building from the ground up allows the weight of the building to be harnessed to do most of the destruction. So the result is an implosion producing a vertical symmetrical collapse at free fall acceleration sometimes into a consolidated rubble pile that's broken up and ready for loading and shipment. Now this is a feat that only a handful of companies in the United States can accomplish, and fire never has. Let's take a look at some of these key characteristics. We have a sudden onset of destruction at the base. We have a straight down symmetrical collapse into its own footprint because demolition waves remove those column supports, resulting in a free fall speed often through the path of what was the greatest resistance, free fall acceleration, faster and faster and faster on the way down, resulting in a total dismemberment of the steel structure for shipping. And there's minimal damage to adjacent structures, sounds and flashes heard and seen by witnesses. Enormous clouds of pulverized concrete from explosives and explosive charges often that are seen at various levels of the building. And, of course, chemical evidence of cutter charges. If you have all of these, you have direct evidence of explosive destruction. Now, fire can't accomplish any one of these, really, let alone all 10 of them. Fire is an organic process that works its way through a building every 20 minutes or so in a given area, looking for fresh new fuel sources as it leaves the area burned out behind. So when a building does fall due to fire, and you'll note that it never has in a steel frame high-rise, but say in a wood frame building, it will fall over organically, asymmetrically. Typically, we have experts that agree, yeah, that's a controlled demolition. That helps. Corroborating evidence from structural engineers, others in the know. Foreknowledge, because these implosions are produced, planned, carried out months in advance. This is all proof of controlled demolition. Now, World Trade Center 7 has an interesting set of characteristics also. We're going to compare them to what you just saw. How many of you have never heard of World Trade Center Building 7? Like me, 4 years ago. Never before. One, two, three. And let's take a look at it. It's 47 stories tall. What would have been typically the tallest building in most of our states. This building wasn't hit by an airplane. And it was about 350 feet away from the North Tower, a football field. So when the North Tower went down, Building 7 suffered a little bit of damage from the core columns. According to the official story, it was not a significant factor. But this building collapses 7 hours later at 5:20 in the afternoon. Are there any characteristic features of Building 7's collapse that reflect those of a typical controlled demolition? Let's see. Do we have a sudden onset of destruction at the base of the structure? Let's take a look at our first look, perhaps, at Building 7, and as it's narrated by Dan Rather.
And what you're seeing are high shots. Now, here we're going to show you a videotape of the collapse itself.
Describe that.
Now we go to videotape the collapse of this building.
It's amazing.
Amazing, incredible, pick your word. For the third time today, it's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before, when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down.
James Migs says this is the way buildings fall down. Dan Rather's using his own intuition. He's telling us that from his rough frame of reference, he's seen these old hotels in Las Vegas, for instance. Let's take a look from another angle. Do we have a straight down symmetrical collapse into the building's footprint from West Street?
It's gone, man.
Let's bring it back up. The penthouse falls a second before the overall collapse, and about 10 seconds after the initial collapse, which NIST says is going on inside the building. I'm not convinced yet. Let's compare side by side and see a known controlled demolition on the right and Building 7 on the left. Is there any similarity between these two structural failures? Is there enough to warrant a new investigation into the possible use of explosives, which NIST refuses to do? After telling us they found no evidence for explosives, they acknowledged that they never looked for them, and they still do. But what they do tell us is that these fires, which are the worst fires we have photographic or video evidence of, was the cause of this building's collapse. Now, if these fires were the cause of this building's collapse, wouldn't we expect it to fall again toward its injured or damaged side, where the fires are? But the problem here is that in this area, NIST says the fire started in this area, right here on the 12th floor next to column 79. The photographs are very clear, and NIST has a photograph that they cite in their Appendix L of their earlier report that says the fires were out in that area an hour before the collapse, so it could not have been the cause of the collapse. Column 79 is cited as the collapse-initiating event. How does that happen? Because this girder, these beams are cited as a new phenomenon by NIST, saying that they experienced thermal expansion, pushing this girder off of its seat on column 79, causing floor 13 to collapse on 12, 12 on 11, etc., all the way down to the ground, and transferring laterally, also at destroying 400 structural steel connections per second. Steve, is that reasonable in your estimation as a 37-year professional?
Basically, the building codes are all written to assure that any deformations in a overloaded member will redistribute to other members, and the intensity of the overload will decrease with distance from the original overload. This is especially in a modern structural system like this, the redundancy is built in, in the design phase, and the whole system is designed to interact so that if an overloaded member If a member is overloaded, the overload will be redistributed to all the surrounding members. And there have been cases of buildings that have burned much hotter and longer than this, and thermal expansion was mitigated by the fact that the material became softer. And as it became softer, it didn't have the capacity to exert the thermal expansion of a solid member that is expanding at a lower temperature, at these kinds of temperatures, then the material becomes softer and would deform laterally and sag and so on and so forth without the thrust that they're claiming or push that girdle off of that column.
Thank you. That's very helpful. And nearly into its own footprint, it falls. How do we bring a building straight down uniformly, symmetrically into its own footprint? We have to remove those, at least the core columns, if not the perimeters as well. 24 core columns within a tenth of a second of each other. These columns have to be taken out. Any deviation in that pattern, the building will begin to tip, like in a normal or a asymmetrical, chaotic, a natural process. How fast is this building falling? Is it falling at free fall? Well, let's listen first of all to Shyam Sunder, who states,
a free fall time would be an object that has no structural components below it. The collapse analysis shows it's that same time that it took for the structural model to come down from the roof line all the way for those 17 floors to disappear is 5.4 seconds. It's about 5 seconds or roughly 40% more time for that free fall to happen. And that is not at all unusual because there was a structural resistance that was provided in this particular case.
So in the draft report, we have the denial of free fall and the manipulation of the mathematics of this building's fall, which has been corrected by high school physics teacher David Chandler, subsequent to this treatise by Shyam Sunder.
We can measure the downward acceleration of Building 7 by video frame analysis. I used a magnifying glass to place markers on the corner of the building on each frame. From this, we can get a data table and various graphs. The slope of this graph indicates acceleration, which is shown here to be about minus 10.279 plus or minus 0.6. Free fall in a vacuum is minus 9.8 in these units. That falls within the margin of error of this measurement. The rate of fall of Building 7 in the first few seconds is indistinguishable from free fall in a vacuum.
And confronted with this information, there was nowhere for
Mr. Sunder
to go
admitting free fall.
So he comes back in the final report and states,
and let me quote, a free fall descent over approximately 8 stories at gravitational acceleration for approximately 2.25 seconds.
So this is about 100 feet of this building's fall. You can see it gaining downward momentum, in fact. So what does Shyam Sunder do with this admission? Nothing. Does he acknowledge the implications of a free-falling building with no resistance under it? No. He states that it's consistent with what's observed. It's consistent with
results of their global analysis.
The computer model that they've created. It's not consistent at all, as a matter of fact. It's direct evidence of explosive controlled demolition, in fact.
Can I just add a point here? When the column is buckling, the minimum, bare minimum, absolute minimum resistance. When a column buckles, the absolute minimum resistance it will give is 25%. There's engineering data on this for many years, many decades. So with the minimum resistance of 25% of the intact column strength, if those columns had a bare minimum of a 2-to-1 factor of safety, which would be absolute minimum, that building could not fall in a natural way at any greater than half the rate of gravity. So the fact that it's falling in free fall means those columns are gone. There is no structural integrity. It cannot happen naturally. There's no chance. And nobody will ever produce a test to show that because that could happen with a structure with any kind of integrity because it can't happen.
And let's see what happens when we have the total dismemberment of the steel structure. It falls like a house of cards. A 47-story steel frame, moment-resisting perimeter building, a very strong column-to-beam connections, very rigid, falls in just four stories. Remember, buildings that fail structurally in natural processes fall over, not straight down like a house of cards. Do we have sounds of explosions heard by witnesses?
Mr. Sunder again.
Which is the equivalent sound to a gunshot blast standing right next to a jet plane engine and more than 10 times louder than being in front of speakers at a rock concert at least half a mile away. Although such a blast could be heard a mile away, there were no witness reports of such a loud noise.
In fact, controlled demolitions can be reduce their audible signature by using smaller and more numerous explosives as well as insulative shielding around them. Or they can use a different technology. In a deceptive controlled demolition, one might use an incendiary, which we'll be looking at in a moment. Speaking of no witnesses, who's this?
When we got to the 8th floor, I started walking to one side of the building. I found something was gone. The first explosion I heard when I was on the stairwell landing, when we made it down to the 6th floor. Then we made it back to the 8th floor, I heard some more explosions.
What sort of sound?
Like a boom. Like an explosion.
And more than one?
Yes.
We started walking down the stairs, we made it to the 8th floor. Big explosion. Blew us back into the 8th floor.
When we get outside, a police officer comes to me and says, you have to run. We have more information of bombs, so you have to run.
No witnesses?
And the whole time you're hearing, thoom, 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 thoom. So, I think I know an explosion when I hear it, you know? I was real close to Building 7 when it fell down, and I don't know, but that didn't sound like just a building falling down to me while I was running away from it. There's a lot of eyewitness testimony down there hearing explosions. I didn't see any reason for that building to fall down the way it did, and a lot of guys should be saying the same thing.
No witnesses?
And then it was like another 2-3 seconds, you heard explosions, like boom, and it's like a distinct sound. It's not like when in compression, like boom, 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 like floors that were dropping and collapsing. This was boom, and like you felt a rumble in the ground, like almost like you wanted to grab onto something. That, to me, I knew that was an explosion. There was no doubt in my mind.
No witnesses?
Yeah, here's one of the guys who can tell you I'm okay, all right? Here, hold on. You want to call your mother or something?
You got to get back. Do we have enormous pyroclastic clouds of pulverized concrete? We'll have to refer to the DVD for that section. All this is direct evidence of explosive destruction. Fire's not available to account for any of it, really.
This is under.
Is that the partial or total collapse of a building due to fires is, first of all, an infrequent event.
Infrequent because we have a 100,000-ton heat sink in the case of the World Trade Center Twin Towers and half that in most other high-rises. They don't fall because this heat is conducted away from its source so that the structural steel never achieves its 1,200-degree Fahrenheit half-strength critical temperature rating. Again, we have almost 100 high-rise fires, not one of which has ever collapsed in a steel frame fire. Not this one, which is fully engulfed in flames in Building 5 at the World Trade Center. It didn't come down. Nor this one. But this one came down, World Trade Center 7, with small fires on one side, isolated pockets, and a lot of smoke. Interestingly enough, on the other side, falling completely into its own footprint, four stories high.
Mr. Jonathan Barnett, forensic fire protection engineer, unable to properly examine the evidence. They were trucking it.
Normally, when you have a structural failure, you carefully go through the debris field, looking at each item, photographing every beam as it collapsed and every column where it is in the ground, and you pick them up very carefully and you look at each element. We were unable to do that in the case of Tower 7.
Now, that's a startling admission from a member of the FEMA team, given that FEMA was in part or directly responsible for the systematic destruction of evidence at 400 truckloads a day shipped to China for recycling before their report came out in May of 2002, citing that they have no idea how this building came down. So let's look at the steel and find out what happened. But it was gone, prompting editor-in-chief building fire expert, what's his name?
Bill Manning.
To cite crucial evidence that could answer the many questions is on the slow boat to China and is showing an astounding ignorance of government officials to the value of a thorough scientific investigation. The destruction and removal of evidence must stop immediately. Do we have experts that corroborate this controlled demolition? Here's Danny Jawenko, the top European controlled demolition expert, 27 years in the business. He says, it starts from below. They simply blown away the columns. It's a controlled demolition. A team of experts did this. Professional work, without a doubt. And AE 911 Truth structural engineer Kamal Obaid, who cites, a localized failure in a steel frame building like World Trade Center 7 cannot cause a catastrophic collapse like a house of cards without a simultaneous and pattern loss of several of its columns at key locations within the building. So the question is Building 7 supportive? If the evidence in Building 7 and its debris and its eyewitnesses and videos, is this direct evidence of explosive destruction? Again, fire can't account for any one of these features. Along with this corroborating evidence that we have, we believe that it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And this is why our literature now throws a third beam up into the New York City evening skyline, which represents the unexplained freefall destruction of Building 7, which is the key to justice for the victims that were killed in the Twin Towers. Speaking of which, let's take a look at the evidence surrounding the Twin Towers and hear from
Gene Corley. Fire caused it.
It was the combination of the impact load doing great damage to the building followed by the fire that caused collapse. We need to look for types of fireproofing that can take the impact and can stand up to the impact and stick to the steel after the impact.
Again, fires have ravaged high-rises well beyond the 2 or 3 hour fire protection rating that these sprayed-on fire-resistant materials have. Why? Because these are huge heat sinks that draw that heat away. The fire protection is not, as it turns out, that critical for these heavy structural steel members. Do we have a sudden onset of destruction at the location of the jet plane impacts? Let's compare the features of the Twin Towers and see how they stack up. Of course, this would be produced by explosions, for which we'll be looking for witnesses that hear those sounds, that see those flashes of light.
Dave Thomas.
The reason that the truth movement needs thermite is there were obviously no explosion sounds, and when you have a controlled demolition, there are big explosions that are, you know, many, many decibels that can be heard miles away, and they go boom, 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 and we didn't hear those.
We didn't hear those. Well, let's take a look at what came out in August of 2005 from the City Fire Commissioner Thomas Von Essen, who recorded 500 of his first responders, and this material was sequestered by Mayor Giuliani. We didn't know about it until August, until the court, New York Court State of Appeals overruled them. Why were they keeping it secret? Is it because 118 of these 500 were documenting sounds of explosions and flashes of light? Let's see. We felt the ground shake. You could see the tower sway, and then it just came down. All of a sudden, the ground just started shaking. It shook my bones. Shortly before the first tower came down, I remember feeling the ground shaking. Why is the ground shaking in what may be 2,000 feet away from what is the beginning of a gravitational collapse with large gradual deformations. Somewhere around the middle of the World Trade Center, there was this orange and red flash coming out. Initially, just one flash. Then this flash just kept popping all the way around the building, and the building had started to explode. Let's take a look and see what the North Tower is doing relative to a known controlled demolition on the left and see if there is any similarity. Slow it down, about half speed. We can start controlled demolitions from anywhere in the building. We'll take a closer look at that in a moment. That's when I saw the building coming down. Pop, pop, pop. Saw a number of brief light sources being emitted from inside the building between floors 10 and 15. No fires on floors 10 and 15. What are these flashes doing? Flashes are an indication of explosive detonation. I saw low-level flashes. We actually heard the pops. You know, you heard the pops. It was blowing out on all four sides. With each popping sound, it was initially an orange, and then a red flash came out of the building. Then it would just go all the way around the building on both sides.
Michael Shermer.
And if you Google any keywords like intentionally demolished buildings or buildings, comma, demolished, whatever, you'll get hundreds of videos of buildings intentionally brought down. None of them fall like the World Trade Center buildings fell. They all fall from the bottom up, and the World Trade Center buildings fell from the top down.
The buildings can fall, or be caused to fall, from anywhere they are designed to be fall, particularly if you're attempting to perform a deceptive controlled demolition to be blamed on jet plane impacts and fires.
John Magnuson.
Several of the upper floors fell onto the next lower floor that was still intact, and once that happens, there's going to be an instant overload situation, and then it will fail. And then that will drop down to the next floor into another instant overload situation. And so the floors just progressively collapse down all the way to the bottom.
The problem with what Dave Thomas is saying is we have measured...
John Magnuson.
Was that John Magnuson?
Yeah.
Okay, well, the problem with what he's saying also is there's no evidence of a dynamic load. He's saying that the building dropped, and if you drop something on something, it can exert more load than its own weight. And the way that happens is a decelerator has to decelerate at a greater rate than gravity. That part of that deceleration involves velocity loss because it's transferring kinetic energy. Kinetic energy is 1/2 mv². It has to lose velocity to transfer kinetic energy. And it has to decelerate at a rate much greater than gravity in order to apply an amplified load. North Tower has been measured. In the last few years, many people have measured it. It never decelerates. It never decelerates. And the same point I'm going to make, the French perform a demolition technique called Vernades, where they don't use explosives. You can use natural gravity, but it has to decelerate. They take out two or three floors with hydraulic rams. They push the columns out of the way. When that upper section comes down and impacts the lower section, guess what? Every single time, in every single Vernades demolition, we measure severe deceleration. That's not true in the case of the North Tower, which we can measure. The South Tower is a little tougher because of the tilt arc. It never decelerates. That means what's actually happening is the legs are being taken out from under it. And these guys just want to go around and say there was an impact. They have no evidence of it. The evidence is that on the contrary.
Thank you, Tony. Let's compare these explosions in the South Tower. Is there any similarity? Is there enough similarity to warrant a new investigation into the possible use of explosives? Should the hypothesis of explosive controlled demolition be looked at seriously? I saw flash, flash, flash. Then it looked like the building came down. What did these gentlemen experience?
We started running. Floor by floor, it started popping out.
It was if they had detonated.
All the way down.
In fact, let's just compare these the destruction of the World Trade Center tower to a known explosion, volcanic eruption in the Tongan Sea on the upper right, a known explosion on the right. What are we looking at? Upward, outward, arching streamers. thick, pulverized concrete suspended in the air, a symmetry, a geometry almost like fireworks. Now, does it look anything like you think a gravitational collapse mechanism might be expected? Now, I missed this 4 years ago. I wasn't thinking, well, 9 years ago, I wasn't thinking at all. I was in a state of shock, probably like the most of the rest of you. I didn't want to think about it. I wanted to accept the answer that was given to us. And that's what we did. We were told it was an orange, and yet we're realizing now that it was an apple. And it is so obvious that many of us, architects and engineers, who finally get hit with a 2x4, which is this evidence, opens our minds and we go, my God, how could I have not seen this? Is that what happened to you gentlemen too?
Building 7 is what caused me to look into this.
Can't hear you.
World Trade Center 7. World Trade Center 7 was the key to me, my starting to have concerns and to starting to look into it.
I will take questions at the end, if that's okay. Go ahead.
Brent Blanchard, explosives photographer, implosionworld.com.
The biggest problem with this whole thing for me is, how do you put explosives in those exact spots where the plane hit, before the plane hit? Because that's where the building failed. Everyone can agree on that.
Well, let's see if that's true. Where did the building fail? This is the North Tower. It's the plane hit down at the bottom of the burnt portion right in this area here. Watch where this building is failing, though.
Second building collapsed while we were on the FDR.
It's what you're seeing is the top descending in what appears to be a mini controlled demolition. In other words, we're told that this 15-story or 12-story portion above the point of jet plane impacts is driving the rest of the building down. But what we're seeing instead is that it has been destroyed in the first 4 seconds.
Second building collapsed.
To know that the actual fares of both towers occurred above the impact damage. In both cases, it was above it. It was the 98th floor in World Trade Center 1 and the 82nd floor in World Trade Center 2. In both cases, there was almost no damage on those floors. A piece of wingtip hit the 98th floor in World Trade Center 1. The rest of the damage was about 2 to 3 stories down.
Dave Thomas. Come on, Dave, speak up.
Hey, you're going to break your toe.
We'll go back and pick Dave up. Dave. Here we go. There's Dave.
If you take a bowling ball and put it on your toe, that's okay. If you drop it from 12 feet, you're going to break your toe.
Right.
And that's just what happens to those buildings. That's why the collapse was considered inevitable, because every floor had even more dynamic force going at it.
This comes back to what I said earlier with John Magnuson. Dave is assuming there's a dynamic load. There's no evidence for it. The evidence, like I said, is to the contrary. He does quite a few things, or quite creative things. This fellow tries to explain the two-thirds of gravitational acceleration, consistent, continuous acceleration, by saying we can't pick it up and that there are impacts, and then when they get averaged in, it would come down to two-thirds. The reality is he says that free falls, and then we have these impacts, which we don't pick up. And like I explained, these other events in France, we pick up the deceleration every time. He also can't have a free fall and then an impact. Like I explained earlier, you can't free fall through buckling columns. They have a minimum resistance of 25% of the original. These columns had 3 to 5 to 1 factors of safety. The fastest these buildings could have fallen, those upper sections through those columns while they're buckling, is about 20 to 25% of that of gravity. And they're falling at 67% of it. So this fellow wants his cake and wants to eat it too, and it doesn't work that way.
The other problem with this is that it's a better analogy would be dropping an egg on your toe. because the top part of the building was not built as strong as the lower parts. The more you go down, it has to be strong to hold what's above it. It's common sense. If any part was going to get crushed, it would have been the top part, and then it should have fallen off the rest of the building, not go through everything and fling it out at high speed.
And you can see those columns being removed in this case here. We'll zoom in right in this area. You'll see a series of explosions racing down the diagonal corner of this building right here, 20 stories below what we're told is a gravitational collapse, pancaking floors. Look at that.
Look at the energy, the horizontal ejections. It's mostly going horizontally.
There's another quick point I'd like to make.
Louder, Tony.
There's another quick point. One of the ways you could repeat the destruction of the towers every time is to take down the core columns, the outer core columns, the ones on the inside, and cut the corners of the perimeter. And then the perimeters are just going to pedal out. But if you look at the debris map, that's exactly what happened. If you cut the corners, you just have a flat sheet. It loses its orthogonal support. So taking down the inside columns where you wouldn't see a lot of the explosions and taking down the corners. And the reason you see those corner explosions there, it looks like the debris curtain covered many of the explosions. But at first, you can see them at first on that corner. The debris doesn't cover the corner as quickly as it covers the sides because the diagonal is further away. So you can only see them at the beginning, but they're there, and they're rapid expulsions. It would be very hard to have a rapid expulsion from the inside go to a further point, which is a diagonal, rather than to the side. You're seeing it come from the diagonal of the corner.
If we can keep watching this loop, you can see that the wave going through the building is at times going as fast or faster than the debris that's falling through nothing but air. How does that happen?
Leslie Robertson, I'm quoting here, right here. Well, that's kind of the nature of that kind of failure. What I can assure you is that once the upper floors of the building started to fall, there was nothing that could have saved those towers. They would have collapsed, in my view, symmetrically.
So he's saying the symmetrical collapse of these buildings is expected. What we have, though, is an unexpected 1,200 to 1,400-foot debris radius, this lateral ejection, everything blowing outside of the building's 207-foot footprint. 98% of that material is landing well outside. This is supposed to be a gravitational collapse, and yet we will be looking, in fact, for a few floors down there, outside the boundaries of ground zero. Here is the classic controlled demolition of Building 7, a nice, neat implosion. Compare that to the very explosive, completely destructive shredding of steel in the very energetic Twin Towers destruction. Do we have squibs or these isolated explosive ejections?
In all the videos of the collapses, explosions can be seen bursting from the building 20 to 30 stories below the demolition wave. Here. Here.
Those are flashes, right? Those are explosive flashes.
Here. 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 And here.
Dave Thomas.
Like the little explosions Richard was describing under the windows, that was the air being pushed out of the towers. When you pump up a bicycle, you can feel that resistance as you're pumping it up. And then it, you know, comes out the tiny needle. Well, that's what was happening. As this big air column was pushed, it came down through elevators, popped open windows, and those were the puffs that you saw even, you know, 30 floors below the collapse front.
The problem is that these are not puffs of air, first of all. They're pulverized building materials. They're being ejected out of the building at 160 to 200 feet per second. These are propelled by explosive speeds, not air pressure. And they're 20, 40, and even 60 stories down below the crush zone, so-called. And if this were, say, the 60-foot open office planning in the Twin Towers and the elevator hoistways, that air is coming down there like that big piston, pushing it into this open area, blowing through the windows behind, that air pressure is going to equalize in those large rooms. And if it blows out any of those windows, it might blow all of them out, but not these highly focalized, geometrically precise, violent ejections that are pinpoint accurate. Do we have a near free fall pace through the path of greatest resistance?
Again, Dave.
Was when I look at my, you know, new physics model and basically look at the fall of the towers as not some average two-thirds sort of average smoothed out acceleration, but what really happened, a free fall and then a violent impact, a collision, a deceleration of 30 G's for only a couple milliseconds.
Again, I alluded to it earlier. This fellow wants to say he has free fall and then an impact. Well, he has no evidence. First of all, free fall can occur, and I explained why. You can't free fall through buckling columns. There's a minimum resistance, and it's high. Even with a factor of safety of just two, it can't fall at a greater rate than half of that of gravity because the buckling resistance is at least 25% times two.
What we're basically told is that this 15-story section here over nothing but air, next to it, a 15-story section held up by this giant crane over, say, 80,000 tons of structural steel designed to resist it, in fact, 3 to 5 times stronger than it needs to be, NIST tells us, but basically these are going to hit the ground at the same time when that lever is released. How many of us think that that is a rational conclusion or hypothesis? This is seventh grade physics.
Right. Well, he says one other thing, Dave Thomas. He says that there's impacts. Like I said, there's no evidence of that. The building has to decelerate, that upper section, and in all of those Voronoi demolitions, that deceleration is measurable. It's not measured in the North Tower. There is no deceleration. There can't be any impacts occurring. So he's wrong.
Here's the problem. That 15-story section doesn't even exist, people. It has been destroyed in the first 4 seconds, as you have already seen. After that, it's the building tearing itself apart and at nearly free fall acceleration, two-thirds of free fall acceleration. So the whole theory of the pile driver in and of itself bears no resemblance to what we see in the video.
And even if there were an intact section, you can see that most of the material, even this early in the collapse, is falling outside the footprint of the building. It can't be pressing on the building if it's outside the building.
Barzan, the vertical impact of the mass of the upper part onto the lower part applies enormous vertical dynamic load on the underlying structure, far exceeding its load capacity.
Yeah, I'll just say real fast. Dr. Bazant is just another one, just like Dave Thomas and John Magnuson, that assumes a dynamic load. They never measured the descent of these upper sections. We have, and they still haven't measured them after we told them they were wrong. They want to assume a dynamic load. That's not science. They never measured for it.
But here's science and experimentation. We learn a lot by looking at what has been done. And here we capture on videos what a building looks like when it's under a dynamic pile driver type load. You'll have to see that one in the video. Do we have the total dismemberment of the steel structure? It certainly appears that way. Let's, in fact, watch the South Tower as only the whole building is destroyed, save these shards of perimeter columns down at the base. Let's take a look at the South Tower now, which was hit down about the 30 stories below the top of the building. Now let's see. Tony, why don't you describe that for us while we...
What are you
let's see if we can get it to play now. No? This building has leaned well off its center of balance. It's the axis of the building. It's 22 degrees and theoretically continuing its angular momentum. How can it drive the rest of the building down when it's falling off the top? We have asymmetrical damage from the loading of this falling piece of the building, asymmetrical damage from the airplanes, and asymmetrical damage from the fires. What do we see from below? When these videos play, what we see is complete symmetry all the way down the building. It's absolutely amazing, just like the firemen described, like belts all the way down the building, where the steel skeleton is broken up and ready for shipment.
Ready? John Magnuson.
Several of the upper floors fell onto the next lower floor that was still intact. And once that happens, there's going to be an instant overload situation, and then it will fail.
Where are the floors, in fact, if that's true? If we have a gravitational collapse down to the bottom, we would be expecting to see 110 floors stacked up, not neatly, damaged certainly, 4-inch thick concrete, an acre in size each of these floors, 220 acres. We'd expect to see maybe half of them, maybe a quarter of them. How many do we see? None. We see a two-story pile of columns, beams. The floors have been completely pulverized, ejected laterally. This bears no resemblance to a classic pancaking collapse. Now, here's a pancaking collapse on the right, where we would expect to see some pancakes.
Yeah, Dave.
A little louder. I can't hear you.
Huh?
Can't hear you.
Yeah. Again, we got Dave.
You know, look at the concrete. It's hard to blow up concrete. It's hard to put dynamite and pulverize concrete. But if you drop it in a gravitational collapse that releases 942 gigajoules of energy just collapsing, yes, that concrete can get pulverized.
Again, Dave Thomas assumes a dynamic load. There's no evidence for it. He also assumes a free fall, which I explained was impossible. So without a dynamic load, the structure is not collapsing, and he is assuming that a priori, and it's not true.
There's so many things wrong with what he's saying and implying. It's hard to know in the time we have what to say about it. I mean, for one thing, a pancaking collapse, even if it destroyed the floors, how would it destroy the columns that were holding up all the floors? It was strong enough to hold a building about six times as tall as it was wide against 100-mile-an-hour winds at the top. Can you imagine the force that the wind would push on those towers with? And they had to not just resist without falling over. They had to not sway very much because people would get seasick in the top floors of the building if it's doing this at the wrong rate. And so you have this incredible stiffness, this incredible reinforced structure for these buildings. And if you have, there's no steel strong enough to just not bend. You also have, you have steel on two sides. If it's getting pushed over to one side, you have vertical strength also, because if you're pushing over, you're also pushing down. So the towers were extremely overbuilt. He throws a fancy word at you like gigajoules, and you go, oh, well, he must know what he's talking about, but he doesn't. You have to just, for the results we got, you had to destroy the concrete. You had to rip the steel apart 80-90%. You see a few big sections falling, but most of the steel you see is ripped apart down to individual steel sections. It's being flung outward. That's more energy. It's being flung. It's being accelerated at two-thirds of gravity downward. That's two-thirds of its gravitational potential energy being converted into motion downward. That leaves you only one-third of the original gravitational potential energy to do all the other damage. The numbers don't add up. You can find these calculations on the Internet. We try to keep it simple and leave it at that. But these models are out there, and we show our work, unlike many of our opponents.
Next, Hyman Brown.
Structural steel is fireproof to last between 1 and 2 hours, which it did, and then steel melts.
Well, what he means is steel softens. But the problem is we don't just have softening steel out there. We do have melted steel. Where did that come from? In fact, it's pouring out of the South Tower, as you can see here, molten metal. What in the world is it? Well, NIST tells us this must be molten aluminum from the airplane. Problem is that molten aluminum looks silvery like that. We have structural engineers citing red-hot molten running from LIRA, Leslie Robertson's office. We have urban search and rescue workers seeing molten metal, red-hot steel being pulled from deep within the pile. What did the first responders, demolition contractors, Peter Tully, who cleaned up this site, he was the president, saw pools of literally molten steel. I'm going to go very rapidly through this. It goes on and on and on. There are dozens of witnesses seeing all of this molten metal. What does it mean? Melted girders, says Abulhasan Astani. Problem is, office fires don't get this hot. They don't get hot enough to make steel girders look like Swiss cheese, as documented in FEMA's Appendix C, which NIST then rejected from their final report. It's hidden. Intergranular melting capable of turning a solid steel girder into Swiss cheese.
The molten metal was only found under the three buildings that collapsed. You all saw a picture of World Trade Center 5, which was burning fiercely, no molten metal under that building. It was only under the three buildings that collapsed that day. So just bear that in mind.
Very good point.
John Gross.
First of all, let's go back to your basic premise that there was a pool of molten steel. I know of absolutely nobody, and there's no eyewitness that said so, nobody who's produced it.
You'd get down below and you'd see molten steel. Molten steel running down the channel rails. Like you're in a foundry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like lava.
They actually melted beams where it was molten steel that was being dug out.
Underground, it was still so hot that molten metal dripped down the sides of a wall.
And the cleanup was very difficult. Steel was coming out red in certain areas from the first couple of weeks at least.
What's the problem with this? The fires are only 1,000 to 1,200 to 1,400, and this says 1,800 degrees. But even so, steel doesn't begin to melt until 2,700 degrees or so. What can produce temperatures required to melt that steel? We'll be looking at thermite, a likely suspect, which produces molten iron at 4,500 degrees. What is thermite?
An incendiary used by the military, thermite is a compound of iron oxide and aluminum, which when ignited sustains an extreme heat reaction, creating molten iron. In just 2 seconds, thermite can reach temperatures over 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit, quite enough to liquefy steel. We know that open-air fires cannot burn hot enough to melt steel. But metal had melted at the base of the towers. Appendix C of the FEMA report describes sulfur residues on the World Trade Center steel. The New York Times called this the deepest mystery of all. Sulfur slightly lowers the melting point of iron, and iron oxide and iron sulfide had formed on the surface of the structural steel. Sulfur used with thermite is called thermate, producing even faster results.
Well, this section of previously molten iron turns out to be molten iron. How do we know that? Dr. Stephen Jones, a physicist formerly from Brigham Young University, examines it and he finds that it's not aluminum from the jet planes because it is molten iron for the electron microprobe data. He finds that it has abundant manganese, so it's not structural steel. This substance is not melted steel. It's molten iron. We don't use iron in buildings today. It's not iron from the alloy, the main ingredient of steel. It's iron, pure elemental iron. And it has other elements associated in and around it, aluminum, sulfur, potassium, manganese, and fluorine in abundance. These are associated only with thermite, or in this, the only likely suspect being thermite. These are Sol-Gel uses fluorine in very special thermite charges. This is a Sol-Gel that can be packed into a thermite-based cutter charge designed to eject molten iron in milliseconds through the orifice of this device, cutting through structural steel, again, in just milliseconds. So, do we have any evidence of thermite in the dust? Let's listen to
Dave Thomas again.
The little iron spheres that he was describing that were the size of a human hair.
Right.
Those are just ordinary iron particles that can come about as the result of the fires burning all that stuff and computers. And they can also be produced by welding and whatnot. So those, you know, do not prove thermite.
Well, is that true? This dust is full of these previous, and this dust landed all across lower Manhattan, many, many square miles. 6% of that dust in many of the samples is composed of previously molten iron, found by USGS, documented by R.J. Lee. Typical in the dust, in fact, it's not even World Trade Center dust, unless it has this previously molten iron. These samples are collected by Dr. Jones. He performs X-ray dispersive spectroscopy. What does he find? That they have this, these iron spheres have the same chemical makeup of the spheres produced from an ordinary thermite ignition. And what else do we find in the World Trade Center dust? We find red-gray chips, hundreds of them in each of the four samplings that this international team of scientists put together. Greg?
Oops. Thomas Eager.
Oh, wait, let's go to Eager first. Thomas Eager.
Well, paint is an excellent explanation for what you found.
Is this paint?
Well, it occurred to us that it might be paint, and before we published a paper claiming outrageous things, we thought we would investigate that and not just wait for a critic to say that. So, in fact, we did test it for the properties of paint in several different ways. I was expecting a different slide. We've engaged in a debate with this person who just, it's like he didn't read the paper. He just assumes it must be paint. I can't be bothered by the facts. He said that we found chromium in the samples. We found chromium in only one sample, and when we washed it in solvent, broke the chip open, and tested it with the X-ray device, there was no chromium. It was clearly documented in the paper. When we heated these chips in what's called a differential scanning calorimeter, we measured how much heat we were putting into it, raised the temperature slowly, and at 430 degrees centigrade, the chips went off. They emitted a lot of heat quickly, and this doesn't happen with paint, dried paint. It just turns into ash instantly, and it doesn't release very insignificant amount of energy. This is high-tech stuff. He ignored all the physical attributes of the material. When you zoom way in, can you go back to the superfine crystal? You see the white particles here. These are particles of iron oxide that are about 40 nanometers across. These are incredibly small, incredibly uniform in size, and intermixed with these aluminum platelets. Aluminum to be formed that way is an extremely difficult process, and to intermix these things and get them to freeze into this pattern, this is the Sol-Gel process, which several U.S. national laboratories have been bragging to each other about their success in creating these advanced, unusual thermite-based and other metal oxide combinations that release incredible amounts of energy when the oxygen moves from one metal to another metal that it's more attracted to. These ultra-fine sized particles have a very high surface area to volume ratio, which is just like stirring something instead of just kind of leaving it one on top of the other. They're mixed together, so the reaction can proceed very fast. We also find the red layer that these are embedded in is some kind of carbon compound with oxygen and silicon, again, similar to what's described in the literature, although we were not able to analyze it far enough to get a chemical formula for it. These materials are not made in a cave in Afghanistan. And if someone wants to come back and say, well, Al-Qaeda must have stolen 100 tons of it, somebody needs to account for that. Either way, we need a new investigation.
So you want to mention the fact that the iron, these chips, when they were ignited, produced iron microspheres?
That's the other part. Thank you. We were motivated to look for these chips because of the iron-rich microspheres that Richard was talking about. And in fact, when we heated the material in the DSC and we looked at the remnant, it had iron spheroids attached to the chip that was not quite completely reacted. That may be the reason we found these chips, is because maybe they weren't made as perfectly as the other material in the buildings. So these are what was left that didn't go off, but we were still able to get them to go off a little bit. And we also heated another chip with a torch, and we filmed it, and it ejected a hot piece, and we tracked it down, and it was an iron spheroid. We measured it under the X-ray. Again, from start to finish, everything was confirmed that this is an extremely unusual engineered material. There's no way it could have been created by accident by airliners made of aluminum impacting steel girders, which has actually been suggested by our critics.
And paint won't produce iron microspheres when you heat it.
Thomas Seagar, upon reviewing your paper, Dr. Stephen Jones' paper, I note the following. 2, the presence of iron oxide, zinc, chromium, as well as 3, the statistical probability of finding these samples all suggest that paint is an excellent explanation for what you found. But you and your co-authors ignore all these facts.
Well, this is the slide I was looking for. It's actually Dr. Eager who's ignoring the facts. He didn't... I don't know how he could have read our paper and written that back to us. By statistical probability, I already talked about the chromium. Zinc also was not found in any of the chips after we washed them, and it was only found on one of them before we washed them. The statistical probability, what he's talking about is he said that we only found one chip in each of our 4 samples, and wouldn't it be strange if you took a little dust here and a little dust there and there was only one chip? There were 62 red chips in one sample amounting to 1.5 grams. There was, you know, some number in another. It's all on the paper. It's just, if you don't want to see it, you're not going to see it.
Experts who are structural engineers, cite Bill Rice, the prevailing theory would have us believe that each of the twin towers inexplicably collapsed upon itself, crushing all 287 massive columns on each floor while maintaining a near free fall acceleration.
Matthew Levy. Ronald Hamburger. It appeared to me that charges had been placed in the building. Upon learning that no bombs had been detonated, I was very surprised.
It's interesting when our detractors actually agree with us, but then something happens to them. Early on, they see, Ronald Hamburger says, it appeared to me that explosives were placed in the building. And Van Romero, who said, in my opinion, it looked like a series of explosions. Later on, something happens. They change their mind. It's really, really quite an interesting phenomenon. Well, all of this evidence appears to be direct evidence of explosive destruction. None of it can be explained by fire. And with the corroborating evidence, we'd like to ask you once more, how many of you believe that the Twin Towers were brought down by fires and jet plane impacts, according to the official story?
How many believe, number one, that they was brought down by the jet planes and fire? Raise your hand.
And how many are unsure?
I think the one person left.
How many are unsure?
Okay. How many do you think that there's some validity to what's been exposed today?
And some of
if you're participating, that would be everyone. Thank you.
Okay.
I don't know the motivations for individuals who do this sort of thing. I do know, however, that they never have an engineering basis for their conclusions.
Well, bless him.
We've gone through the basis for our conclusions, and we had to keep things very rapid paced. There's an enormous amount of evidence that you can follow to its end, and we hope that you will take the time to do that. And look at our website, get our video. You can watch our videos for free on our website if you can't afford it. We make this information available free of charge, and we have... Can you show the
good
paper?
Right. I'd like to, as we close...
We have a paper we did that's, I believe, 16 or 17 pages long, where one of our supporters called these petition signers of ours who are specifically structural engineers and talked to them and got quotes from them. 29 of them seem to think that we have an engineering basis for our conclusions.
What are you saying right here, is it?
Okay.
I believe so.
Thank you. Let's to try to put all this in perspective. I'd like to call upon a Dr. Lance DeHaven Smith. He's professor in the School of Public Administration and Policy at Florida State, a former president of the Florida Political Science Association. Dr. DeHaven Smith is the author of over a dozen books on topics ranging from religion and political philosophy to American government and politics. In 2006, peer-reviewed article, journal article, Dr. Haven coined the term state crimes against democracy to delineate a crime category for Watergate, Iran-Contra, Plame-Gate, and similar conspiracies in high office. Dr. DeHaven Smith's scholarship is nationally recognized. He has appeared on Good Morning America, Today Show, NBC, News with Tom Brokaw, CBS Nightly News with Dan Rather, Jim Lehrer, The NewsHour, and other national TV and radio shows. Oh, there you are.
I'll keep this very brief. I know y'all are worn out. I have a copy of the Grebel Pentagon Papers, by the way. I wish I'd
done that.
And I'd also like to thank Dick Gregory. You know, the Zapruder film that showed Kennedy's assassination was kept from the American people until 1975. And it was shown. Dick Gregory brought it to the Geraldo Rivera show, and it was shown, and that's what led to the reinvestigation of that assassination. I got interested in studying elite political criminality because there is such a thing. We know there's Watergate, Iran-Contra, Gulf of Tonkin. So I coined this term, SCADS, State Crimes Against Democracy, to define this category so that we could study it and also single it out for condemnation and special penalties. You can go on. So I had this definition. The reason I wanted to study it, one is to get away from the idea of conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theory as a category makes no sense at all. First of all, you have conspiracies. We know we have them. Watergate was a very far-flung one. And so when they're true, what's wrong with the theorizing about that? So to condemn speculation about elite criminality is ridiculous. We know it exists. I think we need to return to the founders' ideas about elite behavior. They were very concerned about high crimes and treason. They insisted that everybody who holds office swear an oath. If you look at the Declaration of Independence, I urge you to read that in entirety, not just the first part about inalienable rights, but the rest of it, because what it is a theory that George was conspiring, King George, conspiring against the colonies to put them into, subject them to tyranny. So the Declaration of Independence is a conspiracy theory. It's at the heart of our founding country. There's nothing wrong whatsoever about suspecting elites. That's our job, basically. We should all, as citizens, be vigilant. The other thing about studying this category is if you look across all the events that have menaced our politics since World War II, you see some peculiar and suggestive similarities. Take a look at the assassinations, for example. If this is a bunch of lone gunmen shooting people, why did there's no Supreme Court justices attacked? There's no House members attacked. It's only presidents. It's only senators if they're running for president, or if the Senate is evenly divided. Patrick Leahy, Tom Daschle had an attack on their lives with anthrax. My advice to you is don't fly with U.S. senators when the Senate is evenly divided. It's a dangerous thing. If you look at the scandals that we know about, they center on wars. They lead to wars. There's usually a financial component to them. They also happen in bundles. They're not isolated events. Kennedy gets shot, then Oswald gets shot. Then Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, George Wallace. It happens in sprees. And 9/11 was no different. 9/11 was followed by the anthrax mailing. And we still don't understand that. We may think we caught the guy, and by the way, the official position is it's an inside job, an internal person. But what's unexplained is where did he get the silicon in the coating of it? It was weaponized. At least that's what they said initially. So you've got these very inexplicable things. Last slide. Last thing I wanted to mention, we are expected to not believe our own eyes. That's what the government asks of us. That's what the media asks when they tell us don't be speculating about conspiracies. You watch that film of the collapse of the buildings over and over. You can see it with your own eyes. When the Kennedy assassination film came out that Mr. Gregory brought, it was impossible to disagree that these people were shot from more than one direction and that there were at least three shots into the car that hit, and we knew there was a fourth one. What the government does is develop a lot of tendentious, complicated theories to explain away the stuff that we can see with our own eyes. So I encourage you, as vigilant citizens, to follow up on this. I think the panel was great. And this is the kind of evidence that we need to reopen this issue. Thank you.
Okay. I'm sorry, because of time, we won't have time for any additional questions. But let me further underscore what the good doctor has said. And that is that we can talk about the government does this. Well, the government's made up of individuals. Somebody must be held accountable for what happens if it doesn't add up. And one of the things that this tremendous amount of work that's been done by this group of architects and engineers is they're laying the groundwork where this is not going to die. It's, believe me, this is going to be investigated. Maybe this year, maybe next year, maybe 10 years. It will be investigated. There's too much unknown. But the tragedy is that particularly like with our vice president's got a bad heart, he may not be live long enough to be incarcerated and tried for the criminality that he's performed in high office along with the president. And so let me point out to you that our democracy can only be saved by the actions of people and individuals like this who step forward and do the homework and force it on to government and not government, individuals within government who must be accountable. That is the only way our democracy will survive. And thank you for your attention, and thank you for being here. Thank you.
Awesome.
This is pretty complicated.
Rentals, so we really need people to clear out fast. If you want to connect, please do so, but do so outside the door quickly. Thank you. We got like 4 minutes.
We can answer questions outside.
We can answer questions outside.